Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is a great and rare honour to have the Premier of New South Wales here this evening to introduce our guest speaker. And for those of you who know him, to speak with Premier O'Farrell is to speak, just to be persuaded, in fact, that he is our state's strongest and most passionate champion, and there is little doubt of that. A man of substance and a long-time friend and supporter of the Sydney Institute, please, in the week of his first anniversary in the Premier's chair, make him exceedingly welcome, the Premier of New South Wales, the Honourable Barry O'Farrell.
Lord Melvin Bragg, Gerard and Anne Henderson, my parliamentary colleagues, I know that the Treasurer is in the room. I know that I have a table of parliamentary ministers and parliamentary secretaries down the back there. Members of the Sydney Institute, including its chairman, Nick Johnson. Ladies and gentlemen, firstly, can I acknowledge the traditional owners of the land, the Aboriginal peoples who had their own language and belief traditions, traditions that continue to this day. This was, is and always will be Aboriginal land. Firstly, can I say that for those of us interested in the English language, including those in politics like me who mangle it quite often, Melvin Bragg is well known. Whether through radio, TV or books, the breadth of his work and the reach of his output, even in this media age, is phenomenal. For many, what has been, in the past, their favourite book has been The Adventure of English. Published almost a decade ago, it set out to tell us the story of how what was a dialect for a few local and Germanic tribes numbering about 15,000 people, roughly a town the size of Kiama or Bowral, 1,500 years ago, has spread across the world to be the language of 1.5 billion citizens. The Adventure of English first introduced us to those two remarkable Oxford scholars who fought hard to publish and translate the Bible into English. Now, words, something that Melvin Bragg would tell us is in itself an Old English noun, are deceptively modest things. But when combined, when borrowed, when stolen, when used passionately, when insisted upon, English words have been mustered and deployed by to devastating effect by speakers, by reformers, by radicals, right down the ages. They've outlasted Viking Old Norse. They've outlasted Norman French, and they've outlasted, Your Eminence, the Latin of the Roman Catholic Church. And so, as Lord Bragg explains in his latest book, The Book of Books, English ensured the Christian teaching of the Bible became accessible to every man and every woman without the need for the mediator of priests. English became the superhighway of ideas, mostly in liberal democracies in English-speaking countries around the world, where we are now the beneficiaries of that. Freedom of thought, freedom of expression, freedom to choose our own destiny demands a shared and accessible languages and places to use it. Democracy, frankly, needs words to flourish. And that was true in the marketplace of Athens, where the ideal of democracy was first born, and it's true today in the souks and the bazaars of modern Syria. We write them, we shout them, we tweet them, we often at times misuse them, only to see them spring back fresh for another attempt by us to use them to persuade somebody about something. And like the standard bearers that he usually writes about, Lord Bragg has taken a love of words to a new audience through a 50-year career as a distinguished broadcaster, writer, and historian. That we're here 17,000 years from a small island off the west coast of Europe, speaking English, is, as Melvyn Bragg would have it, a great adventure. But it is worth pointing out that it was a close-run thing, because you'll recall that after a seven-month journey of 17,000 kilometres from England, we only beat the Comte de la Pérouse by 6 days to Botany Bay. And, Gerard, that means that this evening might well have been different. In fact, I suspect the only thing similar about this evening, Gerard, would have been Monsieur Gerard Enderson as our host. The adventure of the point that I think is worth making is that a good deal of the English language ventures into my place of work, the Bear Pit. And despite the best efforts of the Hansard reporters, it doesn't always come out as the Queen's English. It comes out, as Melvyn Bragg might describe it, as battle experienced. At times, sitting through debates, listening to MPs trying to emulate unsuccessfully Paul Keating's great use of words as armoured weaponry against Tories like me, I marvel that expressions that he used, like being thrashed with a wet lettuce leaf, have been espoused by an English language that also gave us the sublime and transformative, in the beginning was the word. Well, tonight, the words belong to Lord Melvyn Bragg. It's my great pleasure to ask him to come up here and talk about the other life of the St James Bible. Thank you.
It always takes longer than you think. Premier, Your Eminence, dignitaries, ladies and gentlemen, I'm honoured to be invited to give this lecture at the Sydney Institute, and I hope I can do the Institute justice tonight. So thank you for such an erudite introduction. I was beginning to think my speech is going to be rather redundant, really. It's extremely fluent and very impressive, as most things about this country are. I'd particularly like to thank Gerard and Anne Henderson for their warm welcome here and encouragement in London and permission to let me make this particular speech, and for their meeting their friends over the last day or two and having such a good time in the short time that I'm here. I've been to Australia a great number of times. My wife was brought up here for many years in Parramatta, and every time I come it gets better. That's not just a compliment because you're here. It's true. It just gets better and better. And it's an extraordinary country. I just missed coming here because of my mother's obstinacy. My father and his brother were set off, and my brother made it, but my father didn't. So there we are. I could have been a contemporary of Clive James. I suppose I am, really. Right. I'm going to talk about the King James Bible, published in 1611, fourth and 400th anniversary, obviously, a year ago. But I'm going to talk about the other life of the Bible. That Bible came out and was spectacularly successful. It was the greatest selling book of the last 400 years, for whatever faith, by a long way. It benefited from being a book of two empires and a book of many nations, and it benefited from contributing to and being part of the liftoff, something your Premier referred to, this great explosion in the English language after years and even centuries of oppression. It leapt out of change, almost literally. For instance, in 1066, Harold Godwinson, the Harold who was shot through the eye or by an arrow in 1066 at the Battle of Hastings, was crowned king in Westminster Abbey in the English language. It took 333 years before the English language was employed in a similar capacity in Westminster Abbey. It was a suppressed language. out of that, like a great suppression that happens in geology, it erupted with Chaucer, then with Shakespeare, then with this great Bible, and spread, as your premier said, all over the world. So this book is about its impact, not on religions, and I hope and I know that this book affects all of us, whether we're whatever denomination of Christianity, or whether we're anti-religious, or of other religions, or atheistic, it doesn't really matter. This is a book of the most spectacular example of unexpected consequences I can think of. The impact of the Bible, putting religion aside, which I'm going to do mostly for this evening, or totally, on language, on society, on democracy, on slavery, on science and other things, but that'll do for me for this evening, has been quite extraordinary. But when you look at the way our history has been written, particularly over the last 50 years, even the last 100 years, it's been airbrushed out of history. The stalk of the Enlightenment, the stalk of economic change, there always is, the stalk of society moving forward, there always is, but the idea that at the center of it was a book, and a book which expressed a religious point of view, has been quietly, and not so quietly, pushed away. We're a much more secularist society back in Britain, and they don't want to see the past like that. We always write the past in our own image, and they don't want that sort of past. It doesn't fit in. And the atheists have got hold of the megaphone, and they don't want Christian past, or any religious past, or any religious influence of any benign way whatsoever. And when I came across that, as it were, realization a few years ago, when I finished a long novel that had completely, I thought, finished me, really, and wanted to write something because I like writing and I wanted to be at the desk every morning, I thought of this, of doing something on this, as an act of restoration. This is really a book of history. And whatever your personal religion or non-religion is absolutely no concern of mine. And I know people are of all the denominations I've mentioned, including several atheists and so on. And they're fine or not fine, depending on what they are as people. But history is something different. History belongs to all of us. History you've got to look after. Because if you don't look after your history, if you don't tell it as it really is, it comes back to bite you in the neck. And also what you do is you, by amputating the past, you condemn yourself to be embalmed in the superficialities of the present. So that's what I'm trying to do. Trying to say, look, what happened in the last 400 years happened in many cases because of the impact of this book on people who didn't believe in the Christianity, in the faith in this book, but it had an impact. It is the most extraordinary phenomenon. So as I say, I think this is an act of restoration. The first battle with the Bible in English was getting it into English. And briefly, it took about a couple of hundred years. In 381 AD, the man who became known as Saint Jerome had translated the Bible into Latin. It was known as the Vulgate. It was the official, Christianity was the official religion of the Roman Empire. Most people understood Latin. The Romans then conquered the known world, were in charge of the known world, as you know. And that held, and it held through the Holy Roman Empire. It held when that disintegrated too. And it held even when nations started to come forward. It held because it was a sacred text. It had become a great sacred text in Western civilization. And sacred texts have power. They have enormous power. We look at Egypt where the sacred texts held there, the priesthood, were really the rulers. They're interconnected, as were the Aztecs, you can go on, in many, many civilizations. And one of the things that power tries to do is to exclude. Exclude as many people as possible. Keep the truth. Keep the power. Keep the juice to yourself. So it was a sacred text, guarded by an extraordinary empire, the empire coming from the Vatican, which was benign, which was had... No, false is the wrong word. It was just a massively influential and successful empire in its own right, exploring every part of human nature, which knowledge gathering was second to none. It knew about the sexual life of people in tiny villages in North Britain. It knew about the texts. It knew about what was going on in different parts of its empire. It was a great empire. They were the keepers of the sacred text. Also, Latin had become the great language of state between, let's call it Europe, between European powers. And again, few people understood it by that time, few people could write it by that time. It was kept close. It was a big nut to crack. What I want to say now is something that I hope applies to the whole of this talk, and that is to do with imagination. When Einstein was asked, what is the most important thing that has prompted you to be the scientist you are? He didn't say my teachers, although he was very good about his teachers. He didn't say Isaac Newton, although he thought that Isaac Newton's was the greatest mind there had ever been. He said, imagination. Above all, imagination. And many of you know that from whatever walk of life you're in, whether it's business or politics or whatever, it's imagination. It's taking a leap into a future that isn't defined. I'm asking you, taking a leap forward. I'm asking you to take a leap back, because that's equally important. We simply cannot understand history unless we use imagination. And it's pointless if we don't. For most of the time I'm talking about, 1611 to 2011, certainly the first 250 years and maybe up 300 years, for most of the time, most people, practically all people to all intents and purposes, absolutely believe that the Old Testament was the history of the world. It told precisely the history of the world. Isaac Newton believed that. Shakespeare believed that. Francis Bacon believed that. They believed that was the history of the world. We have to remember how important that was to them. And they believed that in the New Testament, God had sent his only Son to redeem the world. That was another axiomatic belief. That was what we now call a mindset. It was powerful, it was widespread, and it forms a background to what I'm going to say. Because it was such a strong force, and a force that was being challenged. And it was being challenged by people who wanted the Bible to be in their own language. They wanted people to be able to read and understand the Bible in their own language. And it was happening in many different places in what we call Europe, but it happened most fiercely in Britain. And it began, really got underway, with a man called Wycliffe in the end of the 1370s and early 80s. He was a great Roman Catholic divine based in Oxford University. He wanted the Bible translated to English. He set up a scriptorium in a couple of colleges at Oxford. You can see to this day, you can see the desks where these young undergraduates wrote out, copied, pre-printing, copied out the Bible. They had a system going, a line system going. They then strapped these pages around them, put on long grey cloaks, they were known as the Lollards, and went into the byways with these translations into English. Wycliffe was found out as being deeply concerned, deeply implicated in this, and there was a show trial at Blackfriars in London. And he was condemned to death. He would have been burned, but for the intervention of a man called John of Gaunt, who was the regent of England then, to the boy king, Richard II. John of Gaunt saved him. He went under house arrest for 2 years and died then. 40 years later, the church authorities dug up his bones and burned them. They did that because they wanted to ensure that when salvation came, the body would not be able to join the soul. And that was their final punishment to John Wycliffe. Meanwhile, these young men went round. We think of Oxford scholars at that time as sort of plump and privileged people who went there to get good degrees in law or into the church and rule the place without much effort. It wasn't like that. In records that we have, for the last third of the 15th century, for instance, we've got a small population base here. In the last third of the 15th century, we have examples of at least 150 of these young men tortured and burnt at the stake. Many more were tortured but not burnt, and so on. But they still went round because they wanted this to be in the English language. And the English language came about as a big language because of the blood of men like that, and because of what they did. And what they did was obviously for their religious purposes, but also because they wanted it to be the language of the people. And then along came one of the two great geniuses in the English language, in world English language, and I would hope I can say that unequivocally. We have one, Shakespeare, who's a genius of the imagination. He contributed more words to our language than anybody else. According to a great American scholar, Harold Bloom, his is the greatest mind we will ever know. And we had a second genius, William Tyndale, who was a genius of translation. He's a wealthy young man, an Oxford scholar again. It's a bit of an Oxford story, because there are only two universities, and Oxford did religion better than anybody else. So he came from a wealthy family, and he went to Oxford when he was about 14. By the time he left Oxford at 21 or 22 to go to Cambridge for a year, he knew Anglo-Saxon, French, German, Italian, Greek, Latin, and he was supposed to be the first man in Europe to teach himself Hebrew. He was extraordinary in what he did with learning, but he was even more extraordinary in the way he wrote it down. He wrote the words down. And before that, he had tried to get a job, putting it at the simplest, in London, and gone to a bishop in London and been interviewed. And at that time, we're talking about really powerful state interventions. Nothing moved without being reported. The spy systems of the Tudors were formidable. I mean, they really did. They do make the KGB look to its laurels. And everything that happened of importance was circled by scribes. And at this encounter, because Wycliffe, Tyndale was known as an extraordinary, brilliant young man. There aren't many like that. He was known when he was about 16 or 17. He didn't want to stay at Cambridge, didn't want to stay at Oxford. He wanted to work out in the church, and he wanted to go on with his passion, which was to translate the Bible into English. He'd read a few extracts from something that Alfred the Great had done, and that's what he wanted to give his life to. And in this meeting with the bishop, he didn't lose his temper, we're not told that, but he grew angry when the bishop was calling him terrible names. Those reports are quite hair-raising. And challenging him about this dreadful thing he was doing. Destructive, bringing down the state, rebellious beyond measure, dangerous, translating the Bible into English. It's difficult to imagine, but that's what was going on. And Tyndale rose up and said, I will teach a ploughboy to know the Bible as well as thee. Now that was brilliant, because the ploughboy was the medieval idea of the perfect person. A young man, not formed, working on the land, feeding people, with his direct link back, as they thought, to Christ's apostles. So that was the ploughboy. But much more important, and much more relevant for all of us here, and for the future of the English language, the ploughboy was illiterate. And Tyndale wrote a Bible for people who could not read. He wrote a Bible to be preached. It's a preaching Bible. And he never lost sight of that. And such was that man's genius that he didn't just say, I'm going to do that. He found a way to do it. And he found this way to do it. Here are a few phrases. All things were made by him. In him was life. And the life was the light of men. And here are a few idioms. He contributed more idioms to the English language than anybody before or since, and we use them in one way or another every day. Here's a few. Let there be light. Fell flat on his face. Signs of the times. To rise and shine. A thorn in the flesh. The salt of the earth. The blind lead the blind. Cast the first stone. Every word I've said is a monosyllable. Every single one of those words is a single syllable, which can be understood by anybody. And the Bible is rifted with it. And so is Shakespeare, who took a lot from Tyndale through another Bible. And so is English language literature. It's the great force of it, to be or not to be. The hammer that comes in and defines the moment. And it can be extraordinarily complicated, but it's monosyllables. So it can be understood. Well, he translated his Bible into Greek. He fled to the Netherlands in his late 20s. He went from safe house to safe house. He finished his Greek translation. He sent copies of his Greek translation over to England. He had powerful friends in England, rich friends, both came over. And to give you another example of how different the past was, there was one shipment of 6,000 Bibles. Now, this too, what I'm going to tell you, is completely attested. The Bishop of London bought all of them, all 6,000. And over 3 days, he burned them on the steps of St. Paul's Cathedral to show the people what would come to them if they got hold of this book. Henry VIII put out a royal ship to stop them, and so on and so forth. They were furiously determined not to have this language in their midst. Then Henry VIII had a deep night of reconsideration and decided to leave the Catholic Church and be a Protestant for strictly theological reasons. And so the English language translations came into the country, but not Tyndall. He became such an object of hatred. The saintly Sir Thomas More talked of Tyndall in words that you would not repeat in a bad nightclub. If you want to read them, read them. Loathsome, horrible, disgraceful words he used about this gentle, dedicated, deeply Roman Catholic scholar, Tyndall. Tyndall was still hounded, even after Henry VIII became Protestant, the Holy Roman Emperor had set his spies on them. Judas had his spies on him. He was betrayed by another Oxford man, put into a dungeon for 18 months, brought out way after the Reformation had happened, show trial, found guilty, and before he was strangled, he said, may the Lord open the eyes of the King of England. And then he was burned to the stake, it said, with greenwood so that he burnt more slowly. He was in his late 30s. But his legacy to us is the New Testament and the first five books of the Old Testament. So we go to the King James Bible in 1611. King James VI of Scotland, who was king when he was 1 year old, so he'd been king for 36 years when he came to England. He became James I of England, and he was a great biblical scholar. He was known through Europe for his biblical scholarship. And when it was suggested by a Presbyterian that he have a new Bible, he seized on it, and a new Bible was put together in a few years by 52 scholars, which has made every Hollywood producer ever since said, look, you know, you can have as many writers as you want. The greatest book in the world was written by a committee. Well, it wasn't. They nicked Tyndall, and Matthew Smith, in his introduction, says, we didn't try to make a new book, but to make a good book better. Absolutely true. He didn't say that 85% came from one man, William Tyndall, in the New Testament, and similarly in the first five books of the Old Testament. So the Bible came through, and again, it's very interesting. Tyndall's influence is powerful and pervasive. When those scholars, four groups of them, when they finally sat down in the Jerusalem chamber in Westminster Abbey, you can go to now, and put the final book together, what did they do? They didn't pass notes around to each other. They read it aloud. They read it aloud to each other. It was always, this Bible, uniquely in the world, a preaching, speaking Bible. And it came out, and then we look at the first part of its impact, which is on language. When I say Shakespeare's influenced by the Bible, of course he died in 1615, and the Bible came out in 1611, but Bibles that he had heard, like the Geneva Bible, for instance, that he must have heard in his church and at school, or the Great Bible, had stolen wholesale from Tyndall. In fact, there's almost more Tyndall in the Geneva Bible, which Shakespeare heard, than there is in the King James Bible. So you look at Shakespeare's phrases, and Shakespeare is wonderfully excessive in everything. Shakespeare has 1,350-odd borrowings from the Bible. Quotations, allusions, stories, sentences, whole things he's pinched. He was one of the great stealers, one of the great plagiarists of history, but he turned it into his own. I mean, Holinshed's histories and turned it into the political plays without a qualm. Nowadays he'd be sued right, left and centre, but we have the histories and he wasn't sued. And he took that, and once Shakespeare got hold of it, the gates opened, really. But before the gates open to literature, I just want to say one thing about the people to whom it was addressed, this speaking Bible, and how the gates or the eyes or the ears opened to them. Because the effect of the King James Bible in English is that it gave the English-speaking people permission to think rather than a duty to believe. And the place and power of the King James Version is that it was the medium through which that thought was liberated. I mean, just imagine it. You've been an intelligent person. You've heard bits of scraps at the, if you're lucky enough to be in York or Norwich at the Miracle Plays. You've been way behind the screen of the opera in the church, behind the screen in the cathedrals, screen of what's going on. You've heard little mutterings of Latin, sometimes ill said by people who didn't know much Latin, and so on. That's what you've had. And then suddenly, you get this treasure chest poured on your head. All these words, these stories, Cain and Abel, David and Goliath, Salome, all the arguments in the Bible, the Proverbs, the wisdom, the Psalms, the poetry, the erotica, and so on. You get the Sermon on the Mount. It's all there. It's as if there's been a cavity in your mind waiting to have thought, to put words to thought. All of the sensations you've had are now can be turned into words, and they can turn into other words and into other sensations. It must have been extraordinary. And it was that massive power which I think drove this Britain into such an excess of activity in so many ways in the century or two after the Bible. In literature, well, I don't know where to start and I don't know where to finish, because there doesn't seem to be any finish. I've talked about Shakespeare, but there's John Donne. There are not so elegant books in the world as the Bible. There's John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, at one time his own second bestseller only to King James Version. There's Daniel Defoe, who was trained as a Presbyterian priest, and you remember Robinson Crusoe. When he goes back to the ship to keep getting stuff to build his army, he takes the Bible. It's very important for him to have the Bible, and that plays a big part in it. William Blake, of course, the Bronte sisters, Charles Dickens, the New Testament is the greatest book that ever was or ever will be written, he wrote. And so it goes on right up to today, William Golding. And in America, Moby Dick, Call Me Ishmael is the first line, Herman Melville. You had to know who Ishmael was. You had to know that Ishmael was the illegitimate son of Abraham's second wife, a slave called Hagar, who he married or took to himself because Sarah was sterile. Scarlet Letter and Hawthorne is based on David and Bathsheba. John Steinbeck, The Grapes of Wrath, 12 people on that lorry going across America, the 12 tribes of Israel. There's even Noah there as well. And East of Eden, the Cain and Abel story told twice inside that. Toni Morrison and Beloved, where they speak with the voices of the New Testament. And T.S. Eliot, None Goes in Here. In this country, Helen Gardner, The Spare Room. She spent months reading the King James Bible in preparation for that. Patrick White, of course, Tree of Man and Voss. Thomas Keneally, he was a Roman Catholic, but he plays enormous tribute to the King James Version. Colleen McCulloch and On It Goes. The most surprising thing for me, when I was looking at the impact of the Bible, was the effect it had on slavery. Now, two things. First of all, I'd been told at university that slavery came about through a combination of enlightenment, economic conditions, and so on. Never mentioned the Bible. It's very bad when you just, because the fashion of the times, you cut knowledge out. We're not like that now, so we don't want to have been like then. We don't have been like that then, so we'll cut all that out and pretend it didn't happen. So I came across what was really happening in slavery, and I was amazed by it, by the impact of it. And secondly, and most importantly, it's one of the two things, this is the first, there's another towards the end of this talk, which changed not just the English-speaking world, but the world profoundly. And as far as we can make out, unalterably. Slavery has been in the records of every civilization that kept records. Everywhere you look, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Mesopotamians, the Egyptians, the Romans, the Greeks, right through. Slavery in England up to 15th century, the Tudors had slaves. And what happened here was that slavery was abolished. It still exists. There's still slavery around the world. But the idea of it being absolutely part of human nature, something that was inevitable, something that was good, something that was blessed by God, that has gone. And it went because people used the New Testament as the lever to make it go. That's what happened when you look at the evidence. And it's a scandal that this is not brought into light, because it matters. Whatever your religion or no religion, it matters. And there are two or three ways to look at it. And let's start in London with William Wilberforce in 1789 in the House of Parliament, and he makes a 4-hour speech, brilliantly transcribed, as they still do. There it is. It's supposed to be one of the greatest speeches ever made in Parliament. It's a little book, really. He'd done masses of research onto what the slave trade really was like. He was a very wealthy young man. He'd had a dissolute time at Oxford, but he made a friend of the man who became the youngest prime minister in our country, the younger Pitt. He couldn't have manoeuvred his way forward without that help. And he dedicated himself to the abolition of the slave trade. Now, this was, again, very clever. The idea of abolishing slavery was as if you were saying to people at the time, look, quite soon there are going to be things in the sky, flying through the sky, full of people, and going all around the world. It was just something that was ungraspable. But getting rid of the slave trade was at least possible, and there was reasons for it, because he proved that it was such a hideous, horrible transaction that was going on. He was opposed mightily. Nelson, the great Nelson of Trafalgar, said that he should be whipped and taken through the streets and dragged to Tyburn. He hated him. He was spat out in the streets. He was a wealthy young man, and he needed his wealth. He had the equivalent of security guards around him. But he plugged on. And he was a convert to the New Testament in a passionate way. He read it every day. He lived by it. He wanted to force that idea that is in the New Testament. There is a thread through the New Testament, which is a thread of egalitarianism, which is a thread of all people are equal. And he found texts in that, such as Galatians. There is neither Jew nor Greek. There is neither bond nor free. There is neither male nor female, for ye are all one in Christ Jesus. He used that text. He had to use texts because those who were for slavery, they had their texts. The Bible's full of them. If you want evidence, if you want, as it were, God on your side for the Bible, if you want God on your side, you can find plenty of evidence or plenty of search in the Bible. Noah cursed Canaan, son of Ham, and all his offspring, and condemned them all to slavery. And on it goes. So it's almost a battle of two books, the Old and the New Testament. Wilberforce forced it through. He was a bold man as well. In that first speech, he called in the Liverpool merchants. Now, the Liverpool merchants were making a fortune out of the slave trade, as were the Bristol merchants. A fortune. It was supposed to be somewhere between 25 and 30% of our commerce, this trade. And they sat in the gallery, and they came to listen. And it's reported at the end they wept, whether because they thought they'd lost the case or they were moved, isn't reported. But there they were. And he drove it through and drove it through. And in 1807, the world changed. The slave trade was abolished. And Pitt, his friend, got the Royal Navy on the North Atlantic and stopped other countries taking slaves over as well. It's one of the purest acts in our history. And we ought at least to acknowledge it. So that was one thing that happened. And then in 1833, slavery was abolished, and a slow domino effect went round the world from there. And that came principally from the King James Bible. But there was another source of power. I talked about those who used the Bible to keep slavery intact, but there was another source of real power for the abolition of slavery. And again, that changed the world, and that was the Afro-Americans. The slaves had gone over. Hundreds of tribes with different languages. There's never been anything like it in history. The millions of people that were taking over, year after year, a lot by the Brits. And their friends, all the Northwest Atlantic countries were at it, taking them over. Slaves in the America, they were there. The tribes were split up so that the language could not make them coherent as a force, and so on. They were brought into the King James Bible by white Wesleyan Methodist English Oxford preaching scholars who went to America, George Whitefield and the two Wesley brothers, for the Great Awakening, which you'll know about in America, because the Puritan settlers felt that the grip of the Bible, the Puritan settlers from Britain who'd gone there for a new England, they were the people of the book, they wanted a new start, they wanted God's country, they felt that power and goodness was slipping from them, so they had a revival. And Whitefield was speaking to 30,000 people at a time. Benjamin Franklin, the great scholar, went to his meetings, although he was a Christian, but not an active Christian, but he was amazed by the power this man had. And the Wesley brothers and Whitefield went into the black areas. You can't call them communities. You can't call them plantations. I've been there. I was in this book and seen the churches. And what happened was the tyndall struck again. Because these people, some of whom were extraordinarily intelligent, were mostly illiterate, but they had great muscular memories of an oral tradition. And when the Bible was spoken to them, when the words were spoken, they remembered it. They talked about it to each other, and they took it and built their own churches in the swamps. Some of them are still there. And they talked it over, they talked it to their people. And what the Bible, King James Bible, gave to the black Americans were several things. First of all, there was the beginning of a coherent language. The Bible English became a cohering and coherent language for all these different tribes, expressed in different ways by different tribes because of their own background, but there it was at last, cohesive force. Secondly, because they read, or they heard, that you could praise God by singing and by spiritual values. Well, they knew about that. They knew about songs. They knew about spirits. They had spirits in their own religion. And there were spirits here. There was the Holy Ghost. There was the Spirit coming down when Christ was baptized by John. And on it went. So they knew about that. But most of all, it became a liberation theology. Because they, like Isaac Newton, believed the Old Testament told the truth of the world. And they heard that Moses had gone to Pharaoh and said, "Let my people go." And Pharaoh, because God had commanded Moses, let them go. And they didn't see why they shouldn't do the same. So from then on, it became a liberation theology. And they worked at it right up to Martin Luther King Jr. They took it forward. And it became something that dynamically changed America. And thus, because America became the world empire, dynamically changed the world. And he came from those preachers with that Bible based on Tyndale and based on the words there. As you can hear in the songs, the gospel songs, the spiritual songs, go down Moses, right up to rock and roll songs. They're still there. They're in there. Little Richard, as much as anybody else. And so you have it there. And slavery was abolished. It took a long time. And it had many stages, and nothing happens overnight. But there are certain things that begin, that have a beginning. And the beginning of that movement to abolish slavery was in that book, more than anything else. Other factors conspired, they always do, especially if something's rolling forward, everybody wants to be on the bandwagon. But it started there. There are other areas where it matters a lot. One is, you might be surprised, I was, in science. Now, I take my authority in this little part, because I don't want to dwell too long on it, from a man called Lord Rees. Martin Rees, he's just stopped being president of the Royal Society, he's Master of Trinity College, Cambridge, he's one of the great astrophysicists of the world, and he is not a Christian. Well, he was a Christian, he brought up a Christian as I was, he now has what he calls a tribal. He has a respect for the tribe, for the Book of Knowledge, which that is, King James Bible, and for the tribe, the tribal meeting at parish churches now and then, and so on and so forth. One thing he said that has always stuck with me, and Stephen Hawking said precisely the same thing on a different occasion when I talked to him, and they were both very, very firm about it. There are things that we will never know. Our brains are wonderful, but there are things which will be way out of reach with them. And we have to bear that out of mind. Things are going on there, and who knows, I'm not saying we're going to find a man with a long white beard saying, "I told you so." But there are inexplicables, which we all know in our own lives. We have little pulses when we're in states of passion or depression or excitement, which we can't track down to any notion of reason. But they're there. They're almost like little senses coming from outer space, really. But it's an outer space that's inside us. I won't go any further than that because I can't go any further than that. But that seems to me one thing to say, be warned. Science is not the end of something. It's an inquiry into something. And that's the greatness of it. It keeps being an inquiry. And things keep changing. So people who say we've solved all this, Newton, they thought Newton had solved all that with his view of the universe. For 300 years, nobody dared question it. And it worked. It would still get rockets to the moon on Newton's science. But then Einstein came and changed it. And somebody will come and change Einstein. That's what happens when you do inquiries. Things change. But Martin Rees pointed out that when Newton started to examine the universe with all the new implements, and the Royal Society was formed in 1660, again in Oxford, and it's the oldest scientific society, and so on and so forth. Now, everybody involved was profoundly religious. They didn't do it on the side. Robert Boyle, for instance, father of chemistry and son of the Earl of Cork, wrote more about religion than he did about chemistry, and so it went on. But the major figure here is Newton. And Rees said, why did Isaac Newton say and find the universe ordered with the first cause laid out in this particular way? Very like religion. God decides this. The waters are divided. There's day and night. Things are organized. Newton found the template for his discoveries in outer space in the Bible. And he said himself, with this great unifying principle, almost mind-defying. It's Darwin said that it was the greatest act of thought, imagination, and he also used the word, that there had ever been. The notion of gravity. The way that gravity controlled the universe and controls the glass in my hand. Everything. And Newton said, gravity is God. So the idea of God driving his idea of the universe is there to be read. And religion came in that way and continued in science and continued with other scientists. But I'll move on now to... I was going to talk about Dawkins, but I don't think I'll bother. I'll talk about him in a minute if you want. I've quite a lot to say. If I've got a bit of time in hand. Another area in which you get very little mention of the effect of religion is the empowerment of women in the 19th century. Now, it was a real thing in the 19th century. The suffragettes, the growth of power of women, they're quitting the home in numbers now, going into work and then going into society, then going into politics. It was a drive through. And what you never get is that this was driven by the Bible, but it was. Some of the great women there, Octavia Hill, was a Christian socialist. The Christian socialists, John Ruskin, Charles Kingsley, and people like that believed that their socialism, their politics, and their religion should act together and act on society. She was running a toy shop in East End when she was 14, and she devoted her life to clearing the slums. And she cleared it by social policy. She wanted trees, she wanted them to have gardens, and she took the Bible into every home, and she made them pay for it. She thought that if they got it for nothing, it wouldn't work. And then there were the slum sisters who went to even worse slums, and so on and so forth. And the Bible women, Catherine Booth, the wife of William Booth, the founder of the Salvation Army, the first woman preacher to preach publicly in Britain. They were getting her through the Bible. And they went from there through their beliefs and through the action that the Bible called on them to do or empowered them to do, right into the heart of politics. Josephine Butler, for example, who King Leopold of Belgium called the most beautiful woman in the world. She was the cousin of Earl Grey, the Prime Minister. She, from the age of about 17 or 18, devoted her life to ridding the London brothels of children, of girls. There were about 2,000 at least London brothels in the 1880s, and most of them were populated by girls under 14, mostly. And she attacked that. Again, like William Wilberforce, she came from a very rich background. She was attacked in the street, she was spat at, she was derided in the newspapers, but she kept at it. And she changed the laws about what was permitted for children of a young age. And she got involved in society, in social policy, she got involved in politics, and so it went on. So the Bible had a great effect there, right through. Almost finally, I think I've got about 7 minutes, but I think I only need about five, so I can say two things about Dawkins. I know Richard Dawkins, and I like him, despite everything. I think he's a brilliant scientist. Brilliant popularizer of science. He's not an original scientist, but he's a brilliant, brilliant popularizer of science. If you read his book on the way the eye is formed, it's just wonderful. I just wish he hadn't got involved in all this stuff. Not because I disagree with his atheism, The ideas that he's come up with about how there isn't really a God, they're the sort of ideas that everybody in this room came up with when they're 15 or 16. There's nothing new there. That's not the point. The point is two things. First of all, his nastiness to Christianity in particular. And secondly, I'm afraid, his ignorance. Now, his nastiness is the way he holds Christianity particularly, but all religion, responsible for all the violence and destructive atrocities in the world. It's just not true. Genghis Khan in the Middle Ages, his armies, the Mongols, are reported to have killed more than 20 million people. This is a time when the population of London was 70,000. So you imagine how many went. He wasn't much of a Christian. In 8th century China, there were wars which went on and on and on, and just estimated that about an eighth of the world's population was slaughtered then. Nothing to do with Christianity. I don't think Hitler or Pol Pot or Stalin or Mao had anything to do with any Christian religion or any other religion. It's just not true. And even more importantly, behind the fact is another fact. The idea that Christianity is a cause and that this book is a cause of atrocities is wrong, in my view. What's the cause of atrocities is us. Basically, men who want power over other men and women, and they'll get power whenever they can get it. And if it means grinding people down and slaughtering them, they will do that. That's what you see. That's what you see with Genghis Khan. That's what you see with Mao. That's what you see with Hitler. They want power. And in certain cases, they've used religion, because they'll use anything, any ideology, any supporting army. And religious ideologies are wonderful, because it makes them look above the fray, which is the exact opposite of where they are. So you find again and again in empires people wanting to be gods. The Aztec Empire, he's a god. In Augustus, the first emperor of Rome, he would turn himself into a god after about 3 years. And so he went on. But what they're doing is using religion as an excuse and a camouflage, because it aggrandizes what they do. They are not triggered by religion. I think they're using it for a human and a negative human impulse. One more thing, and that's to do with, I think he's wrong about that. And that's to do with, in a sense, the country we're in now. And I don't choose it because I'm in this country now. I've written about it. And this is where I think it's really beyond bad. Well, a little thing. He said the slaves, you know, were given sops by their masters and told, oh, if you believe in eternal life, that's fine. Don't worry about today. Just get on with being a slave. And so it was used to subdue them. It wasn't like that at all. That is not what happened. He just needed a fortnight's research to find out that it didn't happen. But he was good enough. Anything to slam that. I don't agree with that. He should have taken more care. But one more example, and then I'll move on to my final point. And that's this. He says the Aborigines were miracles of survival, but they had this useless clutter in their heads called dream songs. Now, I think that is praising the clack. I think it's deeply disreputable for a scholar to say that. This is a body of knowledge. Like the King James Bible is a body of knowledge. Like the Greek myths, again, to do with religion, are a body of knowledge. These are great bodies of knowledge. And the dream songs are doing what the Greek myths did, what the Pharaonic writings did, what the West has done in different ways. They're trying to understand the condition in which they find themselves. They're asking precisely the same question we're asking now. Where do we come from? Where are we going? Why does the sun come up? Why are there earthquakes? What's happening? And Homo sapiens has progressed by being a curious species. His curiosity, her curiosity, has been the driving point. And to say the dream songs are useless clutter, well, who knows when they're properly investigated? I don't know. But I'm told by certain people who know about them that they're of more than a little interest. But whether they are or they aren't to us today, who are we to despise what people then thought? And more importantly, and the clinching point is, maybe it's because of the dream songs that they could survive. Has he not considered that? I think that is a big consideration there. And there's more, but that's enough. What I finally want to say is this. I said there were two great points that the impact of the Bible, two great impacts it had. One was slavery, and the other was on modern democracy. Premier referred to the democracy of Athens. That had died away. What happened in the 17th century was modern democracy was reforged, rediscovered, and set on a course that it's still following around the world. As we can see on our news bulletins, it keeps going around the world. It's become a creed and a cry because it has basic elements of egalitarianism and humanitarianism in it. And the Bible, the King James Bible, was there when that was initiated. I'm being elliptical but accurate. In the British Civil Wars in the 1640s, the real problem was that we had a divine king, just as divine as any pharaoh. King Charles I thought that he was divine. His father, James I of the King James Bible, had told him so. He'd written a wonderful book called The Divine Right of Kings. He said, God speaks only to kings, and only a king can speak directly to God. And Charles I, but James I was a wily old chap, and he managed to surf that a little bit. Charles I believed it axiomatically, that he was divine, he could not be touched. There was a surge going on of different religions, particularly different aspects of religions, particularly Presbyterian, with its libertarian feelings and pulses and pursuits. And there was a desire to change, a desire. Now they got these words. Now they were equal to everybody. Now they could talk back to God, is how they saw it. They wanted to challenge that he alone was divine and he alone could talk to you. Well, they could all talk to God now. Henry VIII, towards the end of his reign, when the Bible in English was going out, spoke to Parliament with tears in his eyes, wishing he'd never let this happen, he said, because now every potboy in the country will talk about the Word of God. And then there will be, I can't remember the exact words, terrible trouble and disruption. He was right. And what happened with the Civil War is that they had to find a way to get rid of a divine king. Our usual method in Britain of getting rid of kings we didn't like was tried and tested, and it was assassination. But they didn't want to do this. These were law-abiding religious folk, and they wanted to do it through the law. They wanted the law to take over, the common law, contract law. They wanted the law. So they argued through the Bible. For instance, they would say from Malachi, an abomination is committed. Judah hath married the daughter of a strange god. The Lord will cut off the man that doeth this, meaning Charles. And they would give sermons on this. Charles was up to it. He fought back through the Bible. The authority of obedience unto kings is clearly warranted and strictly commended in both the Old and the New Testaments, he said. There it is said, where the word of the king is, there is power. And who may say unto him, what dost thou? So this is a battle of interpretations of the Bible, very like the slave trade, using the Bible to fight. One of the great things about the Bible, one of the great virtues of the Bible, is that it's absolutely packed with contradictions. And that's been very useful for many people through the ages. So this fight went on. There was a trial by jury. By jury of a divine king in the Great Hall in Westminster. And King Charles I was found guilty by a jury. 3 days later he was executed, and again the world changed. Upriver, about 4 or 5 years later, up the River Thames, there were the Putney debates, where democracy was debated in full spate, openly. Over in America, where so many, one of the great literate exoduses in the world, had gone over to found a new England, because they thought that the old England, God is leaving England, they said. These extremely well-educated men, and they founded a new England there. They got their own assemblies. They got their own organized democracies inside their assemblies, right down the East Coast. They saw this as liberation, and they moved those assemblies into society. And the slow, inexorable march forward of democracy began based on, I think, triggered by the Bible. And that is another impact that affects us all. Finally, President Obama came to talk to the British Parliament about a year ago, I think it was, in that same Great Hall. You can have a good game of football in that Great Hall. It's huge. It's the biggest hammerbeam hall in the world, late 13th century. It was the only thing, the best thing about the old Westminster, most of which was burnt down, but this was entirely preserved. And he spoke well about democracy, seemed to be very American-centred, and that's fine. We had this great spectacle of this black president speaking about democracy in this hall. And I wanted to say, just for the sake of a bit of historical accuracy, that's a very good speech, and I applaud it alongside the rest of us. Why shouldn't you? He's a remarkable man, whatever your politics. It's a remarkable thing he's done just by being there. I wanted to say, just over there, about three tables up, a king, a divinely appointed king, was tried by the common law and found guilty and executed in the legal terms of the time. That was like the shot at Sarajevo that started the First World War. And if you go up those steps behind you, Mr. President, and walk into that building there, it's reconstructed, but that's where a man called William Wilberforce, in 1789, started what you could say the ball rolling for the abolition of slavery, the emancipation of the slaves, and your eventual arrival in the White House. And just across the road, you go out of this door, through that door, just across the road, is where James VI of Scotland became James I of England, and a few months later said, there will be a Bible, the King James Bible. And finally, when you wanted a symbol to show your past, Mr. President, and your view of what the future should be to your people and to the world, you had a photograph taken, and you wanted to align yourself with Abraham Lincoln, thought to be the greatest president ever of the United States, and the president when the slaves were emancipated. And the photograph shows you swearing your oath of allegiance, and you'd asked for the Bible that belonged to Abraham Lincoln, the King James Bible. Thank you.
Yes, indeed. Ladies and gentlemen, against that vast body of knowledge, it is extremely easy to feel like a ploughboy. With the formidable task of proposing the formal vote of thanks comes Carolyn Kay, Fellow Director of the Sydney Institute. Please make her very warmly welcome.
Lord Bragg, thank you for delivering a remarkable address. Whatever one's beliefs, whether they be associated with a specific faith or not, your interpretation of the influence that the King James Bible has had on the development of our society is compelling. We have benefited from your scholarly analysis, encouraging us to view the King James Bible not solely as a religious work, but as a basis for many elements of our society, from simple, enduring idioms to the empowerment of the enslaved and oppressed, to ultimately the fundamentals that form the basis of the modern democratic structure in the English-speaking world. At a time when morals and ethics are being questioned and examined on multiple fronts, I am sure that you have prompted many in the room to re-examine the basis of their principles and values and how they apply them in all aspects of their lives, including family, community, and work. Once again, thank you to Australia Post for sponsoring tonight's dinner. But most importantly, thank you, Lord Bragg, for coming to Sydney this week and sharing your thoughts with us. As a memento of your visit, on behalf of all of us here, we would like to give you this book, titled Beyond Sacred, a record of an exceptional private Aboriginal art collection. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.